Welcome to the Information Security Forum podcast. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert. Our guest on today's podcast is Laura Noreen, VP of Privacy and Trust at Obsidian Security. ISF Managing Director Steve Durbin sat down with Laura recently to discuss data privacy for employees, whether AI is suited for cybersecurity, and more.
So, Laura, thanks very much for stopping by and talking to me today. First of all, just introduce yourself to our listeners. Tell us about you and the kind of things that you get up to.
Sure. I'm Laura Noreen. I am the VP of Privacy and Trust at Obsidian Security, and I also do academic research at NYU's Center for Data Science and UC Berkeley's new Division of Data Science and Information. So I have a background in social science, and I am now working in cybersecurity, and most of what I'm concerned about is how to protect employees' data. And I'm probably one of a very small number of people who has taken that on as a kind of crusade.
So tell me a bit about that. Protect employees' data. This is within the enterprise we're talking about now. So tell me how that differs from anything else.
Well, I can tell you why it's important in cybersecurity or how it comes up in cybersecurity. So as more companies are using more applications in the cloud, traditional approaches to cybersecurity by securing the network, protecting things on-premises doesn't really apply anymore. Mm-hmm. So in order to offer pretty decent sort of machine learning approaches or even just basic statistical approaches, which I'm a huge fan of. We don't always need machine learning. But in order to do any of that, we end up looking at what employees are doing when they log in, where they're logging in from, what kinds of files they might be sending around, who they're communicating with. And that can get to be pretty exciting from a cybersecurity perspective to make sure that you're not having malicious accounts or, you know, the various kinds of street cybercrime. But from a privacy perspective, it means that there's a lot of employee data that is being used to generate this stuff. And so I'm kind of out there figuring out what kinds of guidelines we should be using. Most of the legislation that's out there about data privacy right now is really focused on consumers and not on employees.
Right. And what's the sort of reaction that you get both from the employees, but also then from the employers to that kind of thing?
Well, a lot of the more mature companies are pretty excited to have someone like myself on the team and to have a team that has recognized that this is important, because cybersecurity can be a kind of insular community. Mm-hmm. Most people who work in cyber stay in cyber their entire careers. It's kind of hived off even at the academic level from mainstream computer science. So the kinds of attitudes that get instilled there are maybe not always the healthiest when it comes to privacy. And the new legislative move to put some guardrails on hasn't really hit cybersecurity full on just yet. So some of the more mature companies are really excited that that we are ready for that. We are paying close attention to that. We are developing principles that go beyond the letter of the law, which is pretty exciting for me, because that's kind of why I wanted to work in this field. As an academic, actually, I wasn't getting access to enough data to really be a very good technical ethicist.
Right.
So it makes more sense to work in industry and to really see the volumes of data, the types of data, and the way it's being used and combined. So yeah, our more mature companies are pretty excited about it. Most employees have no idea. So I have no idea. They don't really know what's happening to their data. They don't have much of a voice. Our employees are thrilled. They're pretty... it's a pretty unique group of people, so they're very excited that they get credit for spotting PII and things like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you think employees should care?
You know, in an ideal utopia, it would be wonderful if they didn't have to care and they could just trust that their employers would look out for their data, would never sell it or leak it or use it in nefarious ways or store it to, you know, predict when they might quit or things like that, or try to predict who's being sexually harassed. Mm-hmm. We don't do that as a cybersecurity company, but when I was interviewing for jobs, there were quite a few people who were very excited about using employee data for that kind of sort of minority report at the corporate level.
Right.
How can we predict who's going to do a bad thing? Most of them had not thought very much farther than that. They were really focused on model accuracy, which is why they were excited about me, because I have a data science background. But I also have a social science background. And when I asked them, okay, well, let's say you have a model that you believe to be, say, 85% accurate, which is pretty good for anything that you're trying to predict about social groups of people. What are you going to do if you decide that Alice down the hall is possibly likely to sexually harass Jane at the next event that has drinking? Mm-hmm. And they could not answer that. They have no idea how to tune interventions properly.
Right.
So I was very reluctant to go work for a company like that.
So, I mean, how can organizations continue to safeguard the kind of information that, that you're talking about? I mean, the first step, presumably, is to understand the value of the information that's being gathered and how it can be used. But what are the sort of steps that organizations should be taking then?
We have taken, and I advocate for, an approach that is a little different than what happened at the very early days of data science. So in the beginning of data science, which wasn't that long ago, companies, researchers, whoever, wanted to gather as much data as they could.
Right.
They could see that there was value in it. And even if they couldn't figure out exactly what they were going to do with this particular kind of data today, they would just gather as much as they could. And if they could afford to store it, they would store it. And that was a certain kind of privilege, to store all of this data until you could figure out which model it was going to be useful for.
Mm-hmm.
We have moved to a more mature privacy posture. We do not hoard, and we consider that to be a key privacy principle,
right?
Not to hoard. Don't collect it all. Don't save it all forever. That's actually kind of anti-humanist.
Mm-hmm.
Humans don't last forever. Humans' relationships change over time. Collecting data like that can be very dangerous and in ways that are difficult for technical people to necessarily be responsible for imagining, but I'm pretty good at imagining what can go wrong. So We don't hoard. And we consider certain kinds of data just too sensitive from an empowerment perspective to even collect it in the first place.
So what sort of things are you talking about then?
This was a decision made before I even came to the company, so I will not take credit for this. But this was one of the reasons that I thought, hey, this is a company that's actually quite creative and quite forward-thinking in their posture on this, especially for a cybersecurity company. We decided not to store any content of communication. So if you send an email to someone, mm-hmm. it would be technically quite straightforward for us to keep the body of that email,
right?
Or to keep the body of the Slack message,
yep.
Whatever the communication might be, to keep the content of a file. We just don't do it because for us, it's actually not particularly super useful for our approach to cybersecurity. I mean, mm-hmm. yeah, there'd probably be some advantage to having that in certain circumstances. But the overall lack of empowerment that gives to employees sort of takes power away from them. We know mm-hmm. everything about any Slack communication, any
yeah.
email, any file. That's just a lot of data to have about someone. It's a lot of information to know about what's going on in their mind, and we just don't do it. And I won't name any companies, but there are other companies that have premised their entire reason for being on running models against communications content directly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a wide spectrum of what is and isn't acceptable, and we fall sort of heavily on the, if we don't need it, we don't keep it, and we try to run models that don't involve getting into someone's head quite like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's certainly advice that was being given when we were talking about, you know, GDPR, for instance, coming in. You know, if you don't need the information, don't store it. It's going to cause you even bigger headache if you're holding things that you don't need. So transferring that, you know, into the environment that you're talking about makes perfect sense. But as you point out, there are organizations out there that will gather everything, not just about their employees, but also visitors, you know, from the point of entry into the organization to the point of exit. And I think that very few individuals fully appreciate the amount of information that is being potentially shared and stored. And indeed, the question, I suppose, is do we have a choice anyway?
Well, we are seeing the EU has been an important leader in trying to advocate for consumers' rights,
yeah.
to some degree for employees' rights, although I wouldn't say that that's super strong. I would like to see, you know, students going through more data science training so that they have better data literacy and are better able to advocate for themselves out in the world about what can and cannot be done, just because it's being done now and has the momentum of status quo doesn't mean that that will always be true. It might take some ham-fisted, poorly written legislation mm-hmm. before we get to something that's really meaningful and useful, but I'm hopeful that we will get there.
I suppose the concern that is out there is that increasingly as individuals, you know, we are generating more and more information, whether it be within our businesses or indeed outside. And that data is then being made available to third parties. And that is set to continue. So if I think about things like the way smart cities, for instance, the way that, you know, the ability to be able to track individuals, there have been trials in some of the Nordic countries where, you know, employees have been quite happy to implant chips under their skin instead of, so that they can use that as a security pass and a means of, you know, paying for things. And there hasn't appeared to be, you mentioned the EU, but there still hasn't appeared to be, to my mind anyway, sufficient focus brought to bear on what is going to happen to all of this information. And that was what was behind my question, because, you know, is anybody really bothered about it, is what I'm saying, I guess.
I think it takes longer than we've had. I mean, we're starting to get there, but the way that I like to frame what you just described, the situation where there is more information about any given individual and it can be united. We can actually know more about any given person than we've ever been able to know, at least in terms of data. Mm-hmm. That data is more easily duplicatable and it persists forever. It's going to live longer than our human carcasses will. Mm-hmm. We have not yet grappled with the ethical implications of that. We haven't quite figured out what that means. We're seeing some interesting conversations around biomedical data and genetics. And I think those kinds of conversations, as people get more familiar with what's at stake in those conversations, how do we? I mean, these are incredibly powerful technologies that if we can benefit from them, you know, broadly benefit, we should. But how do we do that without entering kind of a 1984 type of situation? The genetics community has had to grapple with that. How do they make use of incredibly important cell lines that come from a particular individual in a responsible way? And they've kind of started framing the concept of capable guardianship. Mm-hmm. How do you take capable guardianship of this information? So that is different than an ownership model, which is where most Americans and most anyone who's grown up in a capitalist society probably just thinks of an ownership model because right. It's just in their ethos. But I think if there's enough of a momentum, you can shift to sort of a more capable guardianship model. And then things like, well, when do we start to decay data? Can we start to decay more privacy-sensitive data more quickly? So maybe actually there is some value in holding on to communications content for a certain period of time, but then it can auto-decay mm-hmm. rather than relying on something like a right to be forgotten, which a person has to advocate for that right and then exercise the right. And that's actually rather onerous. It's not going to be exercised evenly across the population. Relatively more privileged people who have the understanding of those pieces of legislation and can navigate bureaucratic systems will maybe exercise those rights. No one else will. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, the GDPR is a great starting place, but it also has some room to grow. And I'd like to see those things. And I think over the course of my lifetime, I'm relatively young, we will see that start to shift. But I actually kind of as a social scientist think it's going to take death for us to get there. When we start seeing what happens to the data of dead people and how that can be used, that will strike people at a level that they haven't been hit yet. Mm-hmm. Being surveilled is something they're kind of used to. Right. So an expansion of surveillance doesn't really upset people all that much. They're relatively complacent to it. But say having a chatbot that's trained off of the communication that you had with, say, your wife or your husband or whatever, and then that can persist after death. Maybe that's super sweet. But what if it was an estranged partner and that estranged partner is still chatting with you, even though you have nothing to do with them based on these old transcripts? Mm-hmm. There will be all sorts of funky technologies that aren't exactly illegal, but that strike people as uncanny and uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when the conversation will start to change. I agree with you. We are totally not there yet. Especially if you talk to younger people who have kind of grown up in this mass surveillance time, they're incredibly complacent and they are incapable of even seeing another way. They can't imagine what it would be like not to be tracked on the internet, not to have cameras all over the place. They can't conceive of what that would be like. Why would you object to that? Wouldn't you want it? Isn't it safer? I actually want to know who's liked my Instagram. Don't take that away from me.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a very different way of looking at it, isn't it? I think there's the ethical question about what happens to this sort of information. But I think one of the old chestnuts that always gets thrown out there is this issue of national security. You know, from a government standpoint, you know, we need to have access to it because of and you can pick a whole variety of different reasons, can't you, from a national security standpoint. What's your take on that?
Well, you're correct. It is an old chestnut, and it has actually given cybersecurity kind of a pass in a lot of the pieces of legislation that are out there. You can, as a cybersecurity company, have a legitimate purpose to do lots of things that other companies wouldn't necessarily be so easily able to do. Obviously, there are going to continue to be national security interests that need to be protected, but there is a line between protecting a nation state and surveilling all of your employees in ways that could lead to mission creep, which we see that, you know, let's try to predict who's going to sexually harass whom or who's going to leave the company or who's going to embezzle. I can see that there would be moral arguments behind doing all of those things, but the counterbalance to that is, well, we're probably not going to be very good at it. We're probably going to be even worse at designing interventions that are meaningful and ethical. There is a lot. I mean, to actually figure out where the line is on what is an acceptable practice for a national security purpose and where do things go too far, I feel like you need to get into an actual case. It's mm-hmm. difficult at the level of theory to make some proclamation.
Mm-hmm. And we probably need to be having more conversation about and more debate, right, about what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable. And I think that one of the challenges that we face in this particular area is that quite often either we don't care what information is being collected because, as you've pointed out, that's just, you know, so what? I've grown up with it. Or indeed, perhaps we don't fully understand some of the implications of what could be done with that information. And I think that certainly if I think back to GDPR, you know, when GDPR came in, there was a lot of surprise at the need for it in some parts of the world, looking over at the EU and saying, well, they're introducing this, you know, this is an unnecessary piece of compliance that is going to be, you know, prohibitive, it's going to be increased costs and all of this kind of thing. But actually, here we are just over 12 months into it, and it seems to have been relatively well received. And I think if you look at other parts of the world, you know, the bar is being raised to match it. And so it's having an impact and an effect. And so it strikes me that we probably need something like that in the area that we're just talking about to form some kind of catalyst to get things going. Would that be fair?
I think that would be fair. I think we've had a lot of really interesting conversations about customers who are concerned that any data that we might have could be subpoenaable.
Right.
And that kind of comes at that tension from the back door.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons many of our customers are just absolutely thrilled that we do not store their communications content. Some of their security teams are a little bit dismayed that they can't just click a button and it's like, I need to see the contents of that email. I'm like, mm-hmm. Well, you may need that, but you're not going to get it from our product.
Right.
There's probably another way to do it. We're not going to enable that quite so easily for you. And their CISO is thrilled that they can't be subpoenaed for that. So there are backdoors to the tension between the power of the state mm-hmm. and the desire of companies. And we're seeing some uptake in the United States, some interest in increasingly empowering consumers. I think what we talk about when we talk about privacy in the United States, we have a long history of using privacy as a container for discussing things that have nothing to do with privacy. Mm-hmm. Some of the initial privacy legislation came about around gossip. I'll skip past that. The more modern day version of it came about around a woman and a man who were married and who were using birth control, which was illegal in the state of Connecticut. And the things they were doing in their bedroom were supposedly private. So that mm-hmm. whole case was fought around privacy when really it was a kind of a women's rights and mm-hmm. issue, not a privacy issue. And I think we're making the same. And it turns out then if you use the incorrect framing to fight about something, you get really stupid legislation, which has happened.
Right.
I would like us to shift the entire conversation instead of being about privacy to be about empowerment. Mm-hmm. That would actually probably clarify this national security issue.
Right.
Who needs to have power? For what purposes? Can there be limits to it? You know, what kinds of communication content can be monitored? What's already being monitored? If AT&T has a relationship with the U.S. government, and so they're all of our AT&T content is immediately available to anyone in the U.S. government. That scares the crap out of anyone who's not a U.S. citizen. Mm-hmm. Some U.S. citizens are scared, but most don't care.
Right. What are some of the other things that surprise you perhaps about what you're learning about the area that you're working in?
I was looking for the opportunity to understand the difference between the imagined scope of what could happen, which is, I think, many conversations in the thought leadership, and I put that in scare quotes, the thought leadership camp, is about what we could imagine doing with a lot of these surveillance. Like, what if you had all of this data, then you could do this, and you could do that, and you could do, and a lot of those conversations have some of that quality. And I was really worried that I was going to become one of those people. Mm-hmm. So what has been really surprising is basic statistics, or what I would consider maybe slightly advanced statistics, but certainly not necessarily machine learning, is still quite powerful and still where a lot of the data science work is really happening. The more advanced models are not really ready for something like cybersecurity because machine learning is relatively vulnerable to attack, and cybersecurity is all about, you know, a cat and mouse game where the attacks are always changing. So that's been really surprising. In fact, most of this industry is a little bit too wily for some of the more advanced data science methods. So there's really a lot of space to grow. I mean, I'm sure that there will be some safe mechanisms in which the machine learning model can't just be gamed. But, you know, it's a triumph for basic statistics, basic statistical models. That's been fun because I'm really good at basic statistical models. And I'm this is probably going to be unpopular, but I'm relatively new to cybersecurity. I have been shocked at how much money and agita is spent on marketing. The work is happening at statistical models, and the money is being spent on helicopter rides and a variety of other interesting marketing strategies.
It's a big market. I think that's the point that everybody has realized over the last, you know, few years. If you look at some of the shows that take place, you know, the trade shows, if you go back even, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, the scale of them was very, very much smaller. And certainly we've seen an explosion in that. If you look at the ability for startup cyber companies, for instance, to get funding, whether it be venture capital, private equity, there's no shortage of that. So it's certainly an industry in boom, isn't it? And I think that when you have any industry in boom, then certainly there's opportunity for, as you say, helicopter rides and some of the other things that go on there. The thing that I wanted to come back to you on a little bit, though, is this whole area of machine learning. You know, machine learning is something that, from a cybersecurity standpoint, whilst it isn't a nirvana, it is seen as being potentially a solution to some of the challenges that that the industry does face. And I sort of sense that perhaps you're a little bit more skeptical about the capabilities of machine learning at the moment. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, we've talked, actually, as a company, we've talked a lot about things to be concerned about. So, right. For instance, in cybersecurity, if your model is, okay, you know, you get a new customer, that customer is a company, you would like to understand what is anomalous. If you train your model on that company, it's a new customer, so, you have to start training somewhere, and they're already compromised in some way, then you've just trained your model to overlook the compromise.
Right.
That is very difficult to address. It's relatively simple to explain, but so that's one issue that no matter what aspect of the company you are monitoring, that could be a potential problem. Second is that these models are relatively fragile too, because we don't always know exactly what is happening within them. We can't always tell when they're being attacked or manipulated. So a good example of that would be when the first self-driving cars started hitting the road. One logical way to think about making sure they stopped at stop signs was to train them to recognize what a stop sign looks like, so then they will stop at that.
Right.
But it turns out that if you put a sticker on the stop sign, or if it had gang tags on it, and apparently none of these cars were chested in, you know, more exciting, colorful neighborhoods, they wouldn't recognize it as a stop sign.
Right.
So that's a relatively, you know, it's kind of like an aw shucks story. But if you didn't know what the manipulation was, you wouldn't necessarily know why things were failing. And in cybersecurity, when there's a constant stream of novelty coming both from humans who are mostly predictable, not perfectly predictable, and attackers who are trying really hard to be sneaky, it's dangerous to think that you can rely on these models without constantly tending them like a little toy flower kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's not, you know, that's not a practical approach.
Right.
So it's really difficult to do that kind of work in cybersecurity as it is. It works really well on, you know, a mammogram because nobody is trying to do something weird to breast tissue.
Right.
To game the mammogram. Everybody is invested in knowing the truth.
Right.
So it's actually very difficult to apply in this industry because, A, you don't even know if your training set is good or not. Mm-hmm. This is actually what you want to train on. And, B, you're really, really fragile to any kind of switch in habit or attack, and you can't even really tell very easily when you've been compromised in that way or if it's a meaningful compromise.
Yeah, I think that's really good insight into some of the, I don't know whether dangers is the right word, but certainly some of the traps that might be out there for people who are, you know, listening to this and thinking that, well, machine learning is going to give me all the answers, because it simply won't. It's far too early stage. So some interesting points that you make there. Laura, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much indeed for coming along and sharing some of your insights, some of the things that you're getting up to with Obsidian and some of your research as well. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks.
That concludes today's episode. Our thanks to Obsidian's Laura Noreen, and as always, to ISF Managing Director Steve Durbin. We'll be back soon with another in-depth interview. In the meantime, listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate and review it, and share it in your networks. Be sure to visit securityforum.org to join the conversation on our LinkedIn group, to access the show notes, and to download ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance relating to this discussion. We'll be back soon. Thanks for listening.